This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Starters for the All-Star Game were announced Sunday, and the full player rosters came out Monday. And now it's time to play ball as Cincinnati hosts the 86th Major League Baseball All-Star Game. And here to give us some history of the game and to look at the players chosen for this year's lineups are Greg Rhodes, Cincinnati Reds team historian, sports writer John Irardi, and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Greg, John, and Howard, thanks for coming in this afternoon.
Pleasure.
Good to see all of you. Greg, you're the historian here. How did the All-Star Game get its start? Was this something that the team owners were behind this, or was this driven by players and fans? How did this happen?
It was all driven by a promoter in Chicago. For the 1933 World's Fair, the International Exposition in Chicago in 1933, and it was a sports editor for the Chicago Tribune, a guy named Arch Ward, and he came up with the notion that let's put the best American League players versus the best National League players. Of course, this was at a time before you had interleague play, and so there was a lot of novelty to the whole idea. And Major League Baseball agreed for a one-time deal. That was all. They were just going to do it for 1933 in Chicago in conjunction with the fair, and then that was it. But it got such a resounding reception from the fans and from the sporting press that they continued it. And save for labor strife or whatever, I mean, it has continued to this day. This will be the 86th. All-Star Game, all a tribute to Arch Ward.
A marketing guy, I thought. Yeah.
Considering you've got two newspaper writers here, I think it's nice to be able to give you guys a tip of the hat there. There you go.
And you talk about 86. This is 86th. There were several years there in the early 60s where they played two games
a
year.
Yes. 59-62. It was 3 or 4 years they played two.
Right.
They
so that's why you have the. Yeah, they did. And they would take a day between
all them. The money from the All-Star Game, the proceeds, go to the players' pension fund. Mm-hmm. And in part, the reason they had the two games in that period of time was in order to – because it was very popular, and they thought, okay, we'll add another game, and it'll help pump more money into the pension fund. But in fact – well, which it did, but the ratings and the players' enthusiasm for the second game kind of – deteriorated, so they just went back to one game.
1933, and you know this, I'm sure you guys know this, the first home run was hit by none other than Babe Ruth.
The Bambino.
But first hit?
The very first hit
was a Cincinnati Red.
The only Cincinnati Red on that team, Chick Hafey.
So he was the first Cincinnati Red to make an All-Star team?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the only one on that team in 1933, Chick Hafey.
And batted cleanup, Howard. Right. Hafey's in the Hall of Fame.
Right, exactly.
Although more for his years in St. Louis than his years in Cincinnati. Yeah. But he did play several years toward the end of his career.
And he had a bloop single. That was the very first hit in an All-Star game.
Yeah. Hey, John, as you look at the history of the All-Star game, what do you think have been some of the more significant games?
Well, the significant moment, I think, in All-Star history, Mark, would have been Rose's collision with Ray Fosse in 1970.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you look back at some of the games here, 1938 was fabulous with Johnny Vandermeer just coming off his two back-to-back no-hitters. He got to start, went three no-hit innings. And 53 was a great game because we had, I believe we had Willie Mays in that game. We had Ted Williams throwing out the ceremonial first pitch just home from the Korean War. And, of course, we talked about 70. And 88 was a bit of a dog. And I think
pretty lackluster, wasn't it?
88 is the reason why I think, personally, they went to a fan fest program because they realized if this game's no good, we need something for the fans. And 88 was a terrible ball game.
It's kind of ironic, too, because didn't they have 14 Hall of Fame players, future Hall of Fame players in that game? I mean, it was just star-stacked.
Yeah. But the star of the game was Terry Steinbach.
Hitting, I think, all of about 217.
Right. That's right.
I mean, he made the lineup on the coattails of Ricky Henderson and Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco because the A's were really good in 88, and their fans supported the team. And not unlike this year when the Royals fans really come out and supported their team, That was true in 88, and Steinbach gets in the game, and then by gosh, he hits the winning home run off of none other than Doc Gooden.
Yeah.
And that 88 game, the Reds representatives really didn't get a whole lot of playing time. Larkin got a couple of at-bats. Chris Sabo, that was his rookie year, and he became rookie of the year at the end of the season, was a pinch runner. And Danny
he stole
Jackson
second base. That was the moment,
was
the local
the big
moment
for the Reds fans. And Danny Jackson, who didn't get in the game.
Yep. John, you were talking about 1938. That was the first time that an All-Star game was played in Cincinnati, played at Crosley Field. Johnny Vandermeer is the big star of that, and he's known for pitching those back-to-back no-hitters. From what you know, did he ever get tired of talking about that or having people ask him about that accomplishment?
He never got tired of it. I know that for a fact because he told me that. Yeah. And he said, one good thing, Johnny says, somebody might tie that record. Nobody's ever going to beat it. And actually, nobody's ever even tied it.
That's right.
Yeah,
no,
that is an amazing feat.
I'm sure you had the same experience. I used to run into him down in Tampa at the when the Reds had spring training down there because that's where he lived. And he would come out to the ballpark, Al Lopez. And I used to sit there and talk to him. He loved to talk about it.
No, he was great. He stole just not the local hearts, but he stole them nationally. People could not believe they had the good fortune of seeing Johnny Vandermeer just off consecutive no-hitters to start the All-Star game. That is almost unbelievable.
And, Greg, you did one of the your Reds history pieces, the pregame show, on the fact that there was hardly anybody in Crosley Field the night of that first
It was an afternoon game.
Yeah.
And it was an odd hole day.
Right.
And so I bet it was a typical afternoon game at Crosley Field in that time period. I mean, if they had 4,000 or 5,000 fans on hand, that would have been a typical crowd. And there probably were hundreds of knot hole kids. And, the one knot holer I talked to long after the fact, but he said the interesting thing was that he, as a kid, now, of course, when you're 10 years old, you're not necessarily paying that close of attention to the game. But he said we had no idea, his little group of friends, that Vandermeer was throwing a no-hitter.
Yeah.
Because for one thing, they were 10 years old. And
they were
the other
socializing.
Thing is, there was no column on the scoreboard back in that time period for hits. I mean, they recorded the runs and they recorded the errors. But there was no column for hits, 1938. And so unless you were really paying attention, you wouldn't have known he was throwing a no-hitter.
Unless you were keeping a scorecard or
something. And he said at the end of the game, everybody stood up and cheered like the Reds had just won the World Series. And only then did he realize, heard people talking about the no-hitter.
And Mark, the amazing thing is I believe Vandermeer only maybe had 20 or 25 starts in his major league career before he made that start in the All-Star game. So it was.
And he pitched a very good game.
He pitched, I think, three no-hit innings, didn't he, Greg? Or very close to
he
that?
Pitched, he gave up one hit.
Okay, one
but
hit.
But three scoreless innings, and he got the win.
Yeah.
All in front of the hometown crowd. So that was very cool.
And 1938, the All-Star game was also significant because that was the last All-Star game for Lou Gehrig, right?
Yes,
it would have been. In fact, Lou played in that game. And he also came here in the 1939 World Series, but he'd already been stricken by ALS, and he couldn't play in the World Series of 39 here.
He was a pinch hitter in the 38 World Series, and fortunately, the radio play-by-play, Red Barber's radio play-by-play still exists. We have copies of it over at the Reds Hall of Fame. And when he comes up to bat, just the novelty of seeing Gehrig, because, back then, no TV. Unless no interleague play, so unless you happen to run across these guys in spring training, the Reds weren't in the World Series at that point, so it was like this was a real novelty. And Barber actually says at one point, Lou, there's Larrapin Lou up at the plate, and he says first time we've seen Gehrig, and kind of as an aside, but I'll bet it was unless he had seen him down in spring training, it would have been the very first time he actually laid eyes on Lou Gehrig. That's unimaginable today, but that's part of what made that All-Star game so magical and such a novelty back then.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation about the All-Star game. Now, 1953 at Crosley Field, we had millions of people tuning in for that game, didn't we? Because that was both on TV and radio. So that was a biggie.
And Wade Hoyt would have called that game.
Yeah.
He would have been involved in that. Well, I'm not sure actually if he did. They may have brought in national guys. But I know Wade was involved. They had a big pregame party at the Netherland Hilton, and he hosted that. But yes, and the other interesting thing about that, though, you know, today the All-Star prices are through the roof, the ticket prices, and Major League Baseball sets those ticket prices. Don't yell at the Reds about that, because it's their game. It's Major League Baseball's game. But they've discovered, of course, how much demand there is for those tickets. Well, 1938 and 1953, the first 2 years it was held in Cincinnati, they put very little surcharge. They put very low premium on the tickets. It was practically you were paying what you would pay to go to a regular game. I think the most expensive ticket in 1953 was $5 or $7.
Yeah. I remember seeing, I looked at a ticket from 1938, and it said $3.50 on it. And I looked it up on where it was, and it was actually a great seat. I mean, it was almost directly behind home plate, kind of up at the top of the first deck. And that was a great seat, but it was $3.50.
And Mark, I swear this is true. I talked to a good friend of mine,
John,
at the Enquirer, Tom Gresham, last night, whose dear father Leo, great pitcher, passed away a few days ago. He has the ticket stub from the 1970 World Series, 1970 All-Star Game. Yeah. First row of the green and third base, $14 for an All-Star game. He stayed all 14 innings and watched that great three-run rally in the ninth, and then the significant collision with Fossey at the plate.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about that 70 All-Star game was Pete Rose did not get the start in that game, cannot for the life of me figure out how that happened. I mean, he was coming off his batting championship in 1969, but he didn't get the start. Anyway, comes in the game, and in the ninth inning, when the National League was down 4-1, they came back to tie the game, and Pete came up with the go-ahead run on base and struck out. so disappointing. Of course, only then setting the stage for the miraculous events in the 12th inning.
And when he barreled into Ray Fossey, that was just typical Pete Rose. I mean, that's just the way he played. Like, his hair was on fire.
Yep, he had his best Western Hills fullback imitation going when he hit Fossey, that's for sure.
Fossey, he never really came back from that whole thing.
Well, he actually did. He played nine more seasons, but he was never the
never
same.
Never really an all-star type player again.
1970 is also kind of interesting too, Greg, because that almost didn't happen in Cincinnati, did it?
It didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I cannot imagine the pins and needles that the local franchise, Bob Housen was running the team at that point, and the ownership group must have been going crazy, because Riverfront Stadium was supposed to open in April for opening day, supposed to be ready for opening day 1970, and construction delays of various sorts kept pushing it back and pushing it back. And by June, the Major League Baseball was going to Atlanta to inquire as to whether Atlanta could host the game in case the Reds couldn't get their ballpark open in time.
Yeah.
And, of course, it only opened right there at the very end of June. They
just
only had a couple of weeks
right.
of sort of work on the ballpark. And it still was not quite finished, even on there were some of the concession areas and some of the escalators, elevators.
Some of the restrooms, too.
Some of the restrooms.
It wasn't Atlanta. At that time, they had the similar kind of concrete dome that was Fulton County Stadium.
Yes.
Would have been playing a very similar kind of stadium to Riverfront had it gone down there.
Well, that was the
maybe they could have announced, "Hey, we're in Cincinnati and been in Atlanta,"
and then there nobody would have known,
looked
right?
The same.
They all looked, Pittsburgh,
Philadelphia,
right?
Howard, can you say that 1970 All-Star Game was the start of the Big Red Machine?
Sort of. I mean, it was a demonstration of it for people around the country who hadn't seen it. But I think it actually started a little earlier than that.
When
they started putting together, the group that of Perez and Rose, and when Bench came up, Lee May.
Until Pete came along in that game, Mark. They didn't look like the Big Red Machine in that All-Star game Bench struck out three times.
Right.
Perez at least once. I think Pete might have even struck out twice.
Yes.
Until Greg mentioned that historic 12th inning. I mean, it was – but, that just points up. Who do you think the starters were for the two pitching staffs, Jim Palmer and Tom Seaver?
Right.
We look at the Hall of Famers, but the pitching in that game was fabulous, which is really what set the tone for the 12th inning.
And, of course, that year, the Reds did go to the World Series. They won the National League pennant, and they went to the World Series and lost to Baltimore.
Right, and they were 70-30 in the first 100 games.
Yeah.
I mean, when the All-Star came along, I don't know what the Reds' specific record was at that point, but they were playing 700 baseball and probably had already had a 10 or 12 game lead. I mean, they were already sort of the talk of the baseball world. And then Pete's dramatics there in the 12th inning, yeah, just kind of like shone the spotlight right on Cincinnati, mm-hmm, and gave that team that a little bit of a personality,
yeah,
boost.
And it kind of divided the country, too, about,
yes,
the Reds, too. I mean, some,
yes,
people weren't thrilled with
And in a way that was, you know, there was always, we forget about this today, but there was always sort of an anti-Pete Rose,
right,
crowd,
absolutely,
out there, especially in visiting towns. Well, not in Cincinnati, but in visiting towns. He always,
oh, yeah,
heard the Boo Birds.
Yeah.
And it started in part with that, collision with
Ray Fosse
in the 70 All-Star,
right,
game.
And so 1988 was the last time we had an All-Star game here, and not really a whole lot you can say about that particular game. So I guess we'll move on to 2015. Start lineups for this year. I was glad to see Todd Frazier make it in. That was just incredible how he came from behind and then moved into first place and won that. I was thrilled by that.
Well, what's interesting about that is had he not made the team, had he not made the starting rotation, it's very possible Matt Carpenter would have been in the starting lineup, and maybe not on paper, because I'm not sure that Holiday is playing, but that would have given us three Cardinals in the starting lineup for the National League. That would have been a tough thing to take in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why, and you know, and that's really one of the reasons. I mean, the Reds obviously pushed this vote along, but the fans themselves did it. I mean, it was, you know, all over the social media, people, you know,
and let's
repeating
hope,
it,
and let's hope
around.
That, now, while you're out there listening to this and us talk about the All-Star game, hopefully you're online at MLB.com voting for Johnny Cueto.
How's he doing?
He's actually leading.
Right now,
there are, I think, five candidates,
right,
and all very strong candidates, all guys that you could certainly make a good case for. But Cueto is leading.
The vote
continues until Friday.
Right.
Now let's get Johnny
time
Cueto
to vote
on that
for
team.
Johnny.
And it's interesting. They've done the same thing that they did several years ago with Votto
right,
for the final vote. They teamed up with another team, and Detroit and Cincinnati kind of have this agreement. Okay, you vote for our guy, and we'll vote for your guy. And you know they've got Cespedes
right
on the final vote. We've got Cueto, so we're getting a little help from Detroit too, and we're giving them a little help.
Well, I mean, the thing is with Cueto, we saw him outduel Max Scherzer the other night. That was true All-Star performance, and I think that alone told me he deserves to be on this team, this National League team.
That was as good as I have seen
that
Johnny Cueto pitch.
Who's
the rest of
the? Chapman will be in the in the bullpen,
right?
And so my All-Star moment for this year is that the National League is leading going into the eighth inning. The AL starts to rally. Chapman comes in, strikes out the final out, strikes out the side in the ninth, and walks off with the MVP.
First those bullpen gates open, and it's Rage Against the Machine, and he comes, you know, marching into the
That would be
a nice moment.
That would be a goosebumps moment. That would be a great moment.
Right.
That although I do also want to know whether or not Todd Frazier will be able to play his Frank Sinatra walk-up song when
of course
it comes
he
to
will.
That. There you go.
Absolutely.
Of course he will. Who else is on that National League starting lineup, John?
Well, we've definitely got Buster Posey behind the plate. Just a fabulous catcher for the Giants. Paul Goldschmidt at first base. D. Gordon of the Marlins at second base. Our own Todd Frazier at third base. Johnny Peralta of the Cardinals at shortstop. Bryce Harper, the fabulous young player with the Nationals in the outfield. Other outfielders are listed as Holiday and Stanton. I believe McCutcheon, Howard, is in there
McCutcheon
for one of those guys. And I'm not sure who the third outfielder is going to be. But Holiday and Stanton are both hurt, unfortunately.
Actually, I think there was a possibility that even Jay Bruce might end up because of some of the injuries, because he came in
That would be interesting.
High enough.
But, you know, a great story was written, I think today, Mark, in the New York Times about why Billy Hamilton should be on this team.
Yeah.
And even though he's only hitting 220, if you want to win the game, Billy Hamilton is a great addition to your ball club.
Still the fastest guy out there.
He gets on base.
Yeah. You get on if he gets
scores.
On base.
He's got speed.
Right. Yeah.
What about the AL lineup, John? How's that shaping up?
Well, the AL lineup to me is interesting because
got four Royals on there.
We do, and of course we all know that the Reds had four starters in 1957.
Five
in 1957. The beautiful thing to me, and I think maybe Howard and Greg can comment on this. I think the best player on the field for either team is going to be Mike Trout. I just love this guy of the Angels.
Yeah.
But if you look look at the rest of the lineup, you know, Salvador Perez of the Royals, Cabrera's hurt, so I think Pujols, Reds killer, now of the Angels, he'll be at first base. Jose Altuve of the Astros at second, Donaldson of the Blue Jays, Escobar of the Royals at short, Trout, again, of the outfield, Lorenzo Cain, outfield Alex Gordon, and then Nelson Cruz. Mark, to me, the beautiful thing about this game, and I'd like to hear my two distinguished commentators give their views on this. If you look at this team, there are, I believe, 28 first-time players, 14 players, 25 or younger. I think potentially it would not shock me if we had as many as 20 or 22 future Hall of Famers on this team. The problem is going to be trying to guess who they are because they're all so young.
That's right. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you look up and down that
line. And Howard, we got about 30 seconds. So.
And, you know, a lot of these guys are going to be there someday, but it's hard to pick out which ones.
Yeah, that's why I said you got to take your scorebook.
Right.
Fill out a scorecard
because
this is the game that you want to keep
scorecard. You're
going
to want to keep
that's
it.
That's a memorabilia piece you want to have.
Well, Greg, John, and Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Greg Rhodes, Cincinnati Reds team historian, sports writer John Irardi, and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Lizzie Kibler. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.